Tonight, a very special look at remote viewing through the eyes and the mind of Paul Smith, author of the book Reading the Enemy's Mind, a compelling story about what we did with the Stargate program. We'll be back with Paul Smith in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Smith has a BA degree from Brigham Young University, an MS from the Defense Intelligence College, and a graduate student in the PhD program in philosophy at the University of Texas, Austin. He enlisted in the Army in 1976, served for 7 years in the government's remote viewing psychic espionage program at Fort Meade, Maryland. He is one of only a handful of government personnel to be personally trained in coordinate remote viewing, called CVR. By Ingo Swann at the SRI International, one of the best. He was the primary author of the government's RV program and CRV's training manual and served as theory instructor for the new CRV training personnel. I was proud enough to be able to get an advanced copy of Paul's book some time ago called Reading the Enemy's Mind, where I offered some quotes about that, and Paul was gracious enough to put it in his book. Well worth reading if you love remote viewing or you want to know what really is on the enemy's mind. Paul Smith on Coast to Coast. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hi, George. Hey, it's great to hear you again.
And likewise, nice to have you back too, especially nowadays where there seems to be so much interest in international affairs, more so, Paul, than I've ever seen in my life. I'm going to tell you an interesting story. When I was working in my early television days in Detroit, and we would kick around what kind of stories we put on our local news and things like that, and I used to produce the 11 o'clock newscast, which was the big newscast for our local television station, and all of us at that time, and we were pretty young then, we were in our 20s, all we really wanted to concentrate on was local news, you know, whatever it might be, whether it's the fire, the murder, or the events that happened locally in Detroit. That's what we wanted to cover. Very rarely did we start looking at national news or international news. You know, every once in a while when there was a spectacular story, we'd run maybe 30 seconds. And then when Watergate started to occur, we got more and more interested in that. Now it seems that international news and national news is just as important, if not more so, than local news. And I've got to believe the field you were in, that of remote viewing, probably would be better off to be used today than even then when you were doing it.
Well, I think it certainly would have a lot of value, value that isn't, of course, being realized to its fullest right now. You know, it's interesting. I was just thinking somewhat along the lines of what you were just saying just a couple of days ago. I was thinking, well, you know, we've got such a global focus now. Even people who, you know, four decades ago would have been just out on the farm, they might know what Aunt Sally was doing, you know, the next Sunday. Now they know what's going on in Bangladesh or, you know, the People's Republic of China or somewhere else. And it just seemed kind of odd. But then I thought about it. Today, more than ever before in the history of the world, somebody on the other side of the globe can reach out and touch what has become essentially that person's neighbor and completely on the other side of the planet from him or her in ways that we could never have imagined 40 years ago.
And it can be done instantly.
That's right.
Paul, I want to talk and spend some time this hour about the government and what it did with the program with you and others, and then get into some of the other things we're going to talk about tonight. And then, of course, last hour, we're keeping you for phone calls. Tell us a little bit about the Stargate program and your involvement, how they found you.
Just a quick introduction. The program itself got started really in 1972 in the science lab, SRI International, which used to be Stanford Research Institute, part of Stanford University. It was the CIA was looking for somebody to answer the question, why are the Soviets spending millions of dollars in parapsychology research that made no sense? And, Ingo Swann, who you also mentioned, and Dr. Harold Puthoff, a physicist, who happened to be at SRI, got together in a kind of fortuitous way, and the program started from there. The CIA contracted with them to research this, among other people, including Russell Targ and others. Ultimately, the military got involved, and for altogether 23 years, the program pursued, this strange mental ability that we refer now to as remote viewing, as a means to support national defense. I got into it completely accidentally, well, at least on my part, I had no idea this stuff even existed. It was, I never entertained the idea that government could be involved in this, and just I happened to be in a Mideast, actually a Mideast analyst position at Fort Meade, and a couple of my friends in the neighborhood, whom I didn't have any idea what they were involved in, a couple of them came to me and said, you know, we've been watching you, which was strange in itself.
Exactly. That's kind of jarring when someone comes up and tells you that.
That's right.
We've been watching you.
And they said, we think you might be good in the black program we're working in. And I said, okay. I was always up for an adventure, so I said, okay, tell me more. They said, well, we'd like you to take some tests. So I took the tests, and they ended up recruiting me into this program in a very kind of Men in Black episode. I ended up being a remote viewer. It was something that, you know, a month before I had no idea even existed.
Did you have to take the test first then before they told you what the program was?
Yes, that was one of the conditions. They were looking go ahead.
Had you not qualified, I bet they wouldn't even have told you.
They would have said, well, you know, we appreciate your time, but thanks, but no thanks.
Exactly. And you'd say, well, what was the program? And they'd say, we can't tell you.
It's well, not only that, but my ego would have been destroyed for the rest of my life, so it's a good thing that I guess that I did what I did, whatever. So, yeah.
How did they know to approach you, though? I mean, what did you show them? What did they see for them to come up to you and say, you know what? He might be worth giving this remote viewing test to. Let's check him out.
They were looking for Army intelligence officers who were competent in their field and seemed to be reasonably intelligent and all that, plus interested in things that weren't necessarily normal, so to speak, for an Army intelligence officer. You know, some kind of creative endeavor, art, like painting and drawing, music, languages, or, you know, creative writing and things like that. Well, they discovered I had majored in art in college. I had trained in or was fluent in three different languages. I played guitar, and I wrote short stories. And so they figured, well, this guy's probably worth looking at, you know, so.
So they weren't out there looking for trained remote viewers, because not a lot of people even knew, like you said, what that meant. They were looking for people that they merely thought that could work, and they wanted to test them.
They, in fact, were looking for people who didn't claim to be psychic in the first place. They in fact, didn't want people who thought they were psychic, because those folks tend to have a lot to unlearn. You know, to do go about the way that we were going to be taught how to do it. So, in fact, it was good that I didn't know much about this, didn't care about it, and, in fact, kind of disbelieved in a little bit. I was mildly skeptical about the existence of any kind of ESP.
Paul, tell us about the tests they gave you.
Well, the tests were mostly psychological and personality-type tests. In fact, many of your listeners probably taken some of these. One was the, you know, an extended form of the Myers-Briggs type inventory. There was a Minnesota multiphasic inventory, and there was a couple of specialized ones to evaluate, you know, your feelings and beliefs about different kinds of things. And,
well, explain those first two tests that you just mentioned.
Well, Myers-Briggs assigns four letters as a kind of a pigeonhole you personality-wise, what type of personality you have, and there's this 16 possible different types of personality you could get, and you know, and it's analyzed in terms of whether you're introverted, extroverted, whether you're intuitive or sensing. In other words, do you form conclusions, or do you base it on seeing as believing? You know, emotional versus thinking. What's the other one? Thinking versus judging. I'm sorry. Perceiving versus judging, and they have specialized terms what that means. But you end up with a profile of four letters. I, for example, was an ENTP, which meant I was extroverted, intuitive, thinking, and perceptive. So that was pretty interesting. You know, a lot of businesses use that because even though everyone is different, you can get these broad generalizations about how people might behave in interacting with other people, and how they approach the world. And that's what this was useful for. They were able to tell whether I might be flexible in approaching this new thing, and if I'd be open to inputs that I wasn't usually accustomed to getting, things like that.
Okay, so you take the test. What percent are they looking for success here?
Well, I don't know. That's hard to say. I mean, the personality types they were looking for represent altogether about 10% of the population. It turns out that their net was too narrow. There were a number of personality types who could just walk right in and do this, and virtually anyone was able to do it to some degree. So, you know, sure, there are some personality types that might learn it more easily or deal with it more easily, but in general, if you train people right, anybody can do it, is what it ultimately amounted to.
Were you going in there, Paul, to get trained as well?
Yes, which, you know, of course, in the early evaluation stage, didn't know, but they were actually looking for people to put through this new training program that had been developed out at SRI, and in fact, Ingo Swan was one of the primary movers in that. It was a methodology that Ingo credits Hal Putoff with a great deal of input in, so I call it the Swan Putoff method, which, you know, came to be known as CRV, coordinate remote viewing. Now it's called controlled remote viewing, but it's the same thing. And they had a contract. This is interesting. They had a government-let contract for training, but they hadn't yet identified anybody to be trained. So that was kind of funny. So they were out beating the bushes for people they thought might be good, and they already had one. I was the second one, and they soon identified a third one. And that was the base of the contract. And then someone who was outside the unit, who you've had on your show, and Art Bell's had on a lot, Ed Dames, was brought along later on, and he joined us, although he was not part of the unit at the time. He belonged to a different unit, which thought it might want to develop its own little remote viewing capability.
Ed is remote viewed, by the way, to the Ukraine, where I think he's going to get married. He sent us a picture of his new wife-to-be, and he's very happy.
Yes, I actually saw that picture. You know, the one thing about Ed Dames is he's always doing something that surprises us.
he was the rebel of the group, huh?
Yeah, he was. He kind of lived on the edge of things. And in one way, that kept us from getting stuck in the mud, but it also was challenging at times. So
with this group that has been assembled at this time, who heads it up? Was it Ingo? Was it Putoff? Who was in charge?
Well, as with any government program, that's a bit complicated. We were in the Army program, which actually didn't have any direct official connection except through contract with SRI. So Ingo was, in a sense, a contractor, and Hal as well. The military program immediately was, our unit was commanded by a lieutenant colonel named Brian Busby at that time, and up the chain, you went up through the normal organizational chain to General Bert Stubblebine, who was the commander of the Army Intelligence Security Command, and Stubblebine had a direct interest in what we were doing, although he was pretty hands-off. He didn't come down and micromanage or anything, but he did pay attention to what we were doing and keep track of it through briefings and things like that.
Were you told, Paul, don't say anything about what you folks are doing?
Oh, yes. It was, I mentioned the Men in Black episode a little while ago. It was a lot like that, where we basically, in fact, I wasn't, under many circumstances, supposed to let anybody know I was even in the Army when I was off base, you know, out traveling around or anything like that. And so there were lots of things we couldn't talk about, especially the program. It was what we call a SAP, a Special Access Program. We weren't, there was only perhaps 150 people in the entire country who knew about the existence of that program, who'd been officially read onto it anyway.
Who would interact with you and the group? Would it be some high-level military people? How did you get the information back and forth?
There was a dedicated I guess you'd call it a stovepipe, that would bring taskings in through, you know, different agencies would want to task us, and they would come to, certain operations officers that we had that were really outside the unit. They were at either at INSCOM level or they were at the Deputy Chief of Staff for Intelligence level, although they didn't call it back then. That would get them passed to either our operations officer or our boss, the Lieutenant Colonel. Our operations officer was... now he goes by Skip Atwater. At that time, he was Fred.
Sure.
and Fred, actually, Fred was the one that formed the unit in the first place in a very interesting way. Usually you don't find a lieutenant creating a unit like that, but he happened to be the right guy at the right place when he was a lieutenant, was directed to form the unit, and you know, of course with other people involved, did do so and stayed on as the operations and training officer for 10 years. Developed a great deal of expertise, and lots of legends have formed around things that Skip Atwater did with, of course, the viewers that he was working with.
Were you going to be a lifer in the Army? How long did you plan to stay in?
Well, by the time I'd become an officer, I'd pretty well decided to make it a career. I'd started off as an enlisted man.
Yeah.
Wanted to be an Arabic linguist, and somehow I progressed up through the ranks quicker than I had expected to. The Army kept, you know, I kept thinking, well, maybe I ought to get out, and then the Army would give me one more, yet more interesting thing to do than I'd done before. And, you know, it's really hard to quit when they keep making your life more and more interesting and more fun. And, you know, this remote viewing thing was, I would say, almost the crown of the whole thing, and in many respects it was. And so by the time I got the boring jobs I'd been in so long, there was no point in getting out. So,
did you enjoy working with the people you worked with?
For the most part, yes. With any office where, you know, you're interacting closely, there's personality quirks that, you know, that cause trouble, and, you know, people don't get along and stuff. But for the most part, we did get along very well, and I'm still friends with many of those folks that we were in the office with, you know, the viewers and the others, some of whom, and nobody knows who they are even to this day.
Who trained you, Paul? Was it Ingo Swann and Puthoff, or, I mean, how did that all transpire once you got in there?
It was Ingo Swann. You know, Puthoff had a role. That was the first part of it. We learned up through, you know, the kind of remote viewing we do is called, it has six stages. And Ingo trained us through the basic material all the way up through stage three, which is really the core of what you're doing. And then, because of the various politics, the Army was told to get rid of the remote viewing program, and so contracts that they were working on were canceled. We had no further training from outside. Fortunately, Atwater had kind of anticipated this might happen. He'd gotten a lot of the training material. He'd learned a lot about the process. And we also had another viewer who was kind of the pilot remote viewer that had been trained by Ingo, and he had been trained all the way through. And so the two of them working together then brought the three of us that belonged to the unit the rest of the way up to speed on the remaining three stages, and we became operational from that point.
Did you leave the military also at that point?
Oh, no. We pretended to have left the military. We wore civilian clothes, got to wear our hair long. One of us even wore a beard, you know, and you know, so we pretended to be civilians for the next, well, several years. But you know, as the wheels of the Army grind, eventually I got pulled back to reality, as they'd look on it, and got sent off to Desert Storm, and then I had to wear a uniform again. So
even though the program got canceled, did you come away with it, even with your own abilities, saying remote viewing works?
Oh yes. You know, there was no question in my mind about that. I mean, once you've seen this done enough times and you've done it yourself enough times where you do indeed accurately describe a target to which you have no connection other than your own mental faculties, you know, it seems almost silly to even think that it doesn't work. You know, when I hear people question it, there's always in the back of my mind something, well, you just don't understand.
Paul's incredible work is called Reading the Enemy's Mind. You can find it, of course, on Amazon.com. Is it still in the bookstores, Paul?
It is in some. I think Barnes & Noble usually have a copy or two around. Of course, with any book, after about a year, it kind of disappears, unless it's something like The Scarlet Letter or something's been around.
And then there's a coast-to-coast appearance, and the publishers go, what the heck's going on?
Yeah, I hope they're surprised this time around. We'll see.
Let's talk about your websites when we come back, and also your mission when you were in this program. We'll be back. Paul, what was the mission then for the Stargate group? What were you channeled to do?
Oh, well, that's an interesting choice of words. we were kind of served at the behest of the intelligence community. Any customer that came in with a tasking that seemed to be something we could do, they would, we would work it. And that could be anything from finding hostages or attempting to find hostages to describing the inside of a Soviet chemical warfare plant to missiles, Iranian missiles, and the Silkworm missiles, the Persian Gulf. It was a broad range. It was all, of course, defense related. A lot of it was operational. We did a lot of experimental kinds of things. Of course, they didn't differentiate for us. They didn't want us to know when we were working an operational target, when we were working a research target. And often we didn't even know when we were working training targets. They didn't want our conscious minds to get in the way. So it was all military-related, but a wide variety of things.
Were they serious in their requests for targets?
The customers, you mean?
Yes. Interesting, too, you call them customers.
Well, you tend to do that. In any intelligence discipline, you call the people who... Well, it depends. Sometimes you call them customers. Sometimes you call them consumers. It all amounts to the same thing.
Well, so. Clients? Ever say that? Clients?
Not usually.
Okay.
Because, I mean, these are also military folks, most of them.
Right.
So, we all pretty much work the same thing. I mean, you get transferred, you could end up being on the other end of that process and be, tasking the people you'd just been tasking you, things like
sure.
that.
So when the customer came in then, were they darn serious about what they wanted done, or were they a little hesitant, or did they think, what a man, somebody sent me in here?
Well, usually they, some of them were just seeing what we might turn out. Others were convinced that we'd provide them a good product, and others... we usually didn't get the ones who were skeptical about it. They might be tentative, they may be unsure, but they would at least give us a try. So they'd give us a tasking. And, of course, we viewers never interact with the customers, although at other times later on I did kind of get the feel for what kind of folks these were and what kind of tasking they were giving us and that sort of thing. So.
No.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You were with the program 7 years. Is that the length of the program in total?
No. The actual military part of it was roughly 18 years. At a grand total of 23, there was kind of a parallel military effort during 18 of those years. And so I was there for 7 of those years. Other people were there for varying lengths of time, ranging from about a year all the way up to, I think the longest was probably 10 years. I think it was probably the longest anybody actually served in the unit.
What seemed to be, Paul, their biggest concern? Did you notice with the customers now any immediate concern on their part when they'd come in?
Well, again, we didn't interact with them very much, but the kind of taskings changed with the climate in the world. The Defense Department and the nation's main security concerns. When we first started doing operational taskings, those of us who'd been trained, there comes a point when you stop doing the training and you start doing the real-world things. Our main focus at that point was Soviet research and development kinds of targets, weapons programs the Soviets might be involved in. For example, directed energy weapons, and that they were just now developing and that they... we wanted to know about, the defense establishment wanted to know about, and they didn't have any other means of doing that, so they would target us on that in those situations where they didn't have any other means. But later on, we had a very large focus on the hostage situations in Lebanon, where there were a number of Westerners and many of them Americans who were being held hostage out in the hinterlands or in Beirut or who knows where, and they used us to do that. And then later on, that changed again to counter-narcotics when the hostage situation was resolved, and then as the Cold War was kind of winding down, we became worried about the war on drugs, and so somebody approached the unit, and we were tasked to do counter-narcotics type missions. So, it changed over time.
Were you told when you were successful or not as a group?
Sometimes, but rarely. There was this thinking that who knows when we're actually done with a particular project. There's always possible we might have to go back and revisit that project as viewers. And the one thing you want viewers to be doing is operating blindly. You don't want them to know what the target is. We were kept as blind as possible for the most part. There were exceptions to that. I won't go into all of that. It's too complicated. But generally, the best way to handle a remote viewer is to keep that person blind to the target, because if they're witting, if they are aware of what the target is, then everything they could guess about it, everything they infer, every memory, thing they'd heard about it, whatever, is right there in their conscious mind. And then it's almost impossible to unravel what's the actual signal from what's all of this pre-existing stuff that may or may not be true.
I'm sure you guys got together as a group and kicked around, what's going on out there in the real world? Why do they want to know this stuff? I mean, you guys had to have said things like that to each other.
Well, the funny thing is we didn't usually. And I guess it's not so funny. It's kind of understandable. We were taught not to compare notes. Because, again, you can end up getting contaminated that way. You talk to a viewer that's working on the same project you are, and you start hearing what they're saying, and you're telling them what you're doing, and then it gets all muddled up. And when you go into remote view, it can really mess things up. And so we got to the point where the operational things we were doing, we really didn't discuss with each other. Occasionally, maybe when it was all over, on the few occasions when we did get final feedback, we might discuss it. But in the actual doing of it, when we were actually in the operational phase, we actually didn't compare notes. And we didn't talk about things going on in the world that might possibly be things we would test on either, for the same reason. We didn't want to contaminate each other or ourselves.
Give me an example, Paul. Let's say search for a weapon, some special weapon that the Russians, the Soviets at the time may have had. How did you handle it? What did you do? And how do you pass the information on to them? I mean, what do you tell them, your customer?
Okay. Well, let's say that that the customer knows or at least has gotten word of a secret Soviet weapons test against some indigenous folks in Afghanistan. This was an actual operation, in fact.
All right.
Okay. The customer probably has some notion, heard some reports through other channels that something happened, but is not able to develop any more information on it. So they come to our operations folks and say, okay, we have this tasking. Now, it may actually come down from further channels. They inject it in the system further up. Doesn't matter. The tasking comes in to the operations folks. Those folks figure out how they're going to task the viewers to work it. And, you know, they usually try and get two or three viewers together to work it individually, obviously. And they will come up with a tasking, which is usually a coordinate or something like that, and they'll individually work the viewers. And the viewers will be completely blind. So after the first set of sessions, the analysts will take that information, compare it to what they already know about it, and then determine where the viewers may be on and where the viewers may be off. Then the monitor that's working it may go in, and the monitor is told, okay, well, the viewer A said this kind of stuff in his session. That could be interesting, and we'd be careful not to reveal too much, but obviously if the monitor goes back into the room with the viewer and says, okay, you said this in your session, can you tell us more or tell me more about that, the viewer is going to say, oh, I must have said something that was on at that point, you know. So you can't escape that. There's no way to do that. But nonetheless, the viewer then hopefully then expands on what was said there, and then that is again taken back and compared, and it goes through this process sometimes through as many as 15 or 20, and in some one extreme case with a Iran hostage situation, more than 200 sessions. All together with the viewers working.
And what did the customer then do with the information, assuming it was accurate?
Well, it's standard. You inject it in the system. Now, first of all, they would take our raw data. It would get analyzed. They'd pick out the material that seemed to be accurate in terms of what they already knew about the target. And then that information would be put into a report and sent, you know, through the system, eventually to the Defense Intelligence Agency, which does the analyzing for that collects all the intelligence in. It's kind of the central clearinghouse, analyzed, and then ultimately finished reports would be sent out to the decision makers, people who needed to know, you know, what the information was.
Do you believe at this point, Paul, that you guys were successful in finding things, anything?
Yes, as a matter of fact. The CIA ultimately, after a great deal of delay and aggravation, ultimately released 90,000 pages of Stargate archives. And in those archives, I have found a good deal of information. You know, the original raw data, some of the feedback, some of the analysis, all put together, and you can see where, in a number of cases, we were very successful. Now, when they released the archives, they very conveniently stripped off the operational data, the material that actually told you what the targets were. They conveniently removed a good share of the best, the feedback and the best results, the best evaluations we got. In fact, there'll be, it was really kind of amusing to see this, there'd be this evaluation from one of our customers saying, this project was very successful, the, you know, the remote viewers produced blank. There's this big black square on there, and we have, and there's no way to tell why it was successful. You know, so it was interesting.
Did it get frustrating?
Oh, absolutely. It was frustrating, you know, of course, from this vantage point, looking at that and seeing the, yet again, just evading capture, the smoking gun that we were looking for to show that we really were successful. We knew we were successful. We did get feedback at the time on a number of projects that we knew we were successful on, and hoped that the raw data would then, or I'm sorry, the actual documentary evidence would be available. And yet here, right in some of the most crucial areas, it was redacted. It was blanked out, and you know, tantalizing and yet incomplete. So
how often, Paul, would you guys remote view? Every day? For seven years, in your case?
Yes, you usually worked every day, but you wouldn't necessarily work an operation every day. Interestingly, one of the things, one of the documents I found in the archives was a guide to how much you should work a viewer, and it said, you know, for surge efforts where you really had crucial intelligence development, it was time-sensitive and all that, you could work a viewer up to 2 to 3 times a day, but it was not recommended to work a viewer on a, you know, high-intensity kinds of things, kinds of operations for long periods of time, and the recommended amount was an operational session every other day. But on the days we were working in operations, we may do training targets of some sort or some research kind of a target.
Did RV see things in real time, or do you also see things in the future?
Well, I like to say there is no such thing as real time. The present doesn't exist. All you have is the past, the very recent past, and the future. Because, in fact, humans have this consciousness window. They have, I don't know, it's roughly a tenth of a second, that it takes our senses to recognize things that have happened and pass that information in to be processed in the perceptual process. And consequently, for example, you asked that question to me, that seemed immediate. It was really, there was this slight time delay, kind of like radio has, you know, to avoid me saying some four-letter word you don't want to hear, right?
Right.
So.
Not that you would.
Not that I would, absolutely. What it amounts to is that humans don't perceive time in the immediate present tense the way we presume we do. We have the illusion of that, but it really isn't the case. So we either live in the past, we actually live slightly in the past in a very interesting way. So that totally had nothing to do with anything, really, in answer to your question. I'll tell you right now, most remote viewings we did had to do with the very recent past or the true past. A few were done towards the future, and even fewer of those were successful. I had one particular experience, which I've related before, and maybe at some point, if you want me to do it again, I will, where I actually described a very, in very excruciating detail, an event that didn't happen for another 50 hours.
Go ahead. Tell us it.
Okay. Well, what happened was I was tasked to, or I was asked to go over to the operations building where we did all our viewing and do an operation. Now, I had no idea what sort of an operation it was. It turned out it's what we call a directed search, which is essentially go out and look around and see what the heck's going on and let us know. It's sort of a walk through the neighborhood to see if there's something we need to be aware of, right? The words in the tasking were something to this effect. Describe the most important event for us to know about in the next few days. Now, of course, the viewer doesn't get that tasking. The viewer gets an arbitrary number that has been assigned to stand for that tasking. And I got the number, and I started describing this structure. I perceived a metallic structure, and it was in the middle of the water, and it was at night. And then I all of a sudden realized it was moving, and I was getting input of radars and weaponry and anti-submarine warfare, and I came to an analytic conclusion that this is a warship, and I had sort of an impression it was a U.S. warship. And I described that a bit, and then I had this further impression of an aircraft off in the distance orbiting around, which ultimately dropped a one or two cylindrical, long, thin cylindrical objects with little stubby wings that made guttering sounds and flew around in a kind of random pattern. Then it developed that, these are all my perceptions now, the flying tubes come together with the vessel, and there is smoke and consternation, and the superstructure of the vessel cants over, and I had an impression of fire hoses on the deck, and all this is going on, and my monitor says, okay, well, where is this aircraft being directed from? And I, somewhere far inland, I perceived that this was in a enclosed body of water bounded by sandy areas, and this third world country, flat roof buildings, even some domestic animals in the street, it seemed like, was where the control was coming from. And, you know, there was more involved here, and eventually the monitor says, well, you're off. He had expected me to develop some other kind of information.
Right.
He said, you're off. Nobody can be on all the time. This, by the way, was Ed Dames. I guess I might as well say that. He said, you're off. No one can be right all the time. Let's go home. It was the weekend, you know. So I threw the session in the safe, and we went home. Well, Monday morning, Skip Atwater calls me and says, Paul, where's that session that you did on Friday? I said, what's in my safe? Why do you care? Yeah, well, I didn't say quite that rudely. I didn't mean to be rude. I said, it's in my safe, but so what? I was off. And he says, you haven't read the papers this morning, have you? I said, what? And I open up the paper, and a U.S. frigate had been hit by, it turned out, two Exocet missiles fired by an Iraqi jet.
Oh, my. I remember that story.
Yeah, yep. The USS Stark. And sometime later, I got the after-action report, the official Navy after-action report in a class I was taking on indications in warfare intelligence, or I'm sorry, indications in warning intelligence. And in the after-action report, I was able to trace my session in terms of the details I provided with that after-action report, and it was amazingly accurate. And I don't say that to brag, because I will admit right now I've never had a session that good before or since. That was one of the cleanest remote viewing sessions I've ever seen.
Why do you think? Were you in a different state of mind? Was it something you ate? What happened?
It may have been something I ate, all right. No, you know, I don't know. And to this day, of course, there's so many unknowns about remote viewing that it's hard to say why it happened. It would be very good to know, because we could duplicate those circumstances and hopefully, you know, have a similar success some other time. But
sure.
But we don't know. There's so much we don't know about this. And the shame is that there is not enough research going on to find those things out anytime soon. But that's a whole different thread to talk about. This particular event was just astonishing, and it's fairly rare because, as I mentioned before, remote viewing isn't particularly reliable in terms of foretelling the future. And I like to joke, when somebody finds out you're psychic, they want you to do one of two things, or maybe both of them. One is to find something that's lost, usually valuable, or someone who's missing, or they want you to predict the future. And both of those are the hardest things for remote viewing to do.
They sure are. Stay with us. Paul Smith, our guest. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about human consciousness and how remote viewing is accomplished. We'll be back. Well, let's talk a little bit about the push for blocking the strength of the paranormal away from all of us. Something's going on. People don't want us to know about it. What do you think's happening?
Well, yeah, that I think is a major problem. I think people don't realize the extent to which the news of developments in this field are being withheld or being blocked, as you said. Interestingly, you know, if you went back to the 70s, you'd see that there were dozens of laboratories around the United States researching parapsychology-type things. Most people aren't aware of this, but there are less than a handful. There's really only one or two laboratories today that are engaged in serious research in the paranormal in the United States. The center of mass of this research has moved to Europe because Europe seems to be more accepting of this sort of thing. The United States seems increasingly hostile to that, at least as far as funding and acceptance in the, you know, among the elite, so to speak. which is too bad. I mean, we used to kind of be ahead of the rest of the world in this kind of research, and now it's, in a way, has been suppressed because of the way things are going.
Well, remember Dr. J.B. Rhine and what he used to do at Duke University? I mean, all that's gone away.
It really has. Rhine was the one that invented modern parapsychology, and his legacy is no longer here.
And I think we talked a little bit about my aunt Shafika, mm-hmm. You know, whom Ingo Swann just thought the world of.
Yes.
I mean, she devoted her entire career to that area.
Yes, she was a very valuable researcher, made some important contributions. And at that the time she was working, there were many people in the field. But as time goes on, more and more of these efforts are going away, and really there are only a few folks. Ed May, who was part of the remote viewing program, the research arm of the remote viewing program, he has a small effort still, but it's kind of a one-man show in a way. He has some assistance from out. Joel McMonigle still works with him a bit. Really, Dean Radin at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, he's in a way the lone gun out there in an institutional setting working on this material in this really frontier of science. The Rhine Institute really doesn't do much research anymore. The PEAR lab, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, is slowly going away, and there's not much left, and it's a real shame. And I think the reason is because there's a concerted effort by the skeptical community to persuade mainstream science that there's nothing to this, which is actually false. There is a lot to it, and there's been a huge amount of scientific advancement in the last 2 to 3 decades, which is going unacknowledged and unappreciated, unfortunately.
I agree with you, Paul. Why do you think, on the face of it, that remote viewing works? When you look at it, you know, trying to ascertain, okay, you've got people who are thinking, letting their minds float out there to pick up information. When you think of that, you go, oh, my God, how can that be? But why does it work? How does it work?
Well, my answer to that question actually is part of the reason why all of this trouble is happening as far as parapsychology research is concerned. The answer is we don't really know how it works. And in science, if you can't come up with a theoretical framework to explain the causal mechanisms that make something work, then science doesn't know what to do with it and wants to either ignore it or condemn it or whatever. And of course, that's the situation here. The unfortunate thing is science's mission, allegedly, one of its missions anyway, is to pursue the unknowns and clarify the unknowns. And yet science is very conservative in that if there's something that's so unknown that they don't know what kind of a theoretical base to put it in, they tend to avoid it when they ought to be looking into it.
Do you think this is a conspiracy to withhold, a conspiracy to keep the paranormal world away from most people?
You know, I use that term a lot, conspiracy of skeptics. Perhaps I'm misusing the word a little bit. Conspiracy implies a plan or an attempt to do something illegal or something immoral or something like that. You know, obviously skeptics have a belief. They're firmly convinced that they're right, and so in that sense, it really isn't a conspiracy. And yet, the way it works out is very conspiratorial in many respects. There's this kind of collusion in the skeptical community, interacting with the mainstream science community, that is working to withhold this information from the rest of the public through whatever means possible. It's a very concerted effort. They work a lot like a political party, rallying the troops when there's perceived threat to their base. When the enemy, the so-called enemy here, the parapsychologists, seem to be making some headway, there are all kinds of measures taken to try and keep the parapsychologists from emerging in public with any kind of apparent progress being made. The worry is, and this is voiced by Carl Sagan in his book, The Demon-Haunted World, the worry is that if you open the door a crack to one aspect of parapsychology, then all of the superstition of the ages will come flooding back in, and it took science 500 years to get all that out the door and close the door on it. So there's some psychology going on here, but nonetheless, it's a, I think that this agenda to suppress this material, I think it's harmful both to science and to the human race.
Well, I think you're right, Paul. I think it's also sad that it's not being pushed the way it used to be. Is it a sign of the times? What has faded away? I mean, programs like this and others are very successful. There's obviously an audience out there for it. There's an interest out there for it. Yet the scientists seem to stay away from it.
Well, part of it is that some of the research, probably a goodly share of the research, wasn't fruitful. There were blind alleys that they went down and started off very hopeful, and the research was pursued in parapsychology, and certain experimental paradigms didn't prove out to be as successful as people thought they were. But you're bound to get disappointments in any aspect of science. I love the story about Edison, who told somebody once, and of course this is probably apocryphal, who knows, but allegedly told somebody once that he'd tried 99 different substances for the filaments of his light bulbs, and they had failed. And the person said, well, it must be discouraging to have failed so many times. And it said, well, I didn't fail 99 times. I just found 99 things that didn't work.
Exactly. Yeah. Very positive about it.
Yes. And unfortunately, mainstream science isn't that way about parapsychology. Again, since they have no way of explaining how it works, they're already going to be biased against it. And even when the things that do work come out, they can't explain it, and so they try and find alternative explanations. Usually they'll allege fraud or imply fraud. Don't always allege it, but they'll imply fraud, or they'll imply poor analysis or sloppy experimenting. And sometimes that stuff is true. You know, some parapsychology experiments have been sloppily done. What the skeptics are succeeding in suppressing is the fact that their objections have one by one been met by parapsychological science over the past 20 to 30 years. Those objections have been met one by one, and frankly, the skeptics no longer have a valid argument against the science that's being done.
Does it bother you that the people like the Amazing Randys of life are out there as skeptics, or do you think that's healthy?
Well, to a certain extent, that's actually valuable, because parapsychology, the progress would not have been made in parapsychology that has been made if it weren't for the skeptics. They have been the ones that have forced, you know, clean experimentation, rigorous protocols, and those kinds of things. Not to say that the early parapsychologists didn't have that in mind, but any time you have confrontation such as that, resistance, it forces you to clean up your act, to be as rigorous as you can be, and it's been very healthy for parapsychology up to a point. When you get to the point, though, that your even your successes are going unacknowledged and fizzling out, you know, not receiving any acknowledgement whatsoever and not sparking further research, which is the most important thing, that's a huge discouragement, and that may play a role, I suspect it does, in the fact that all of the parapsychology labs in the United States and programs have gone away for the most part.
What can we do as a radio show, as a huge base of listeners? What can we do to help this?
Well, I want to say the first thing, but there's not a first thing. There are several important things to do. One is to educate. We should all try to educate ourselves about the facts of this. Go out and see what actually has been done. Now, one thing is that can be a bit boring, because we're talking here scientific research as opposed to some of the more exciting tales about bizarre happenings in the netherworld. You know, one of the things that the skeptics are able to seize on is there are truly bizarre and unfounded claims about paranormal events, about paranormal activities, about things that people claim about the paranormal, that the skeptics can grab a hold of, show without any reservations that these are false, you know, they're imaginations, they're who knows what is the result of it, but there's no substance to it. But of course, the skeptics take it a bit step further, and they pride themselves on their logic, on their critical thinking skills, and yet they make many errors in logic in their opposition to this material. They will, for example, say, okay, we have debunked this set of people over here. There's no substance to their claims, and anyone can see that now, which does happen. Anyone can see that these are phonies, so to speak, whether intentionally or not. So therefore, anybody who makes claims like this are phonies. And of course, that's a logical fallacy. Just because some subset of a population are wrong or mistaken in their claims doesn't mean all of that population are, all of those scientists, all of those researchers. In fact, you have to examine the claims of each one ultimately. Obviously, that's a huge set. You'd have some triage there to pick the ones who seem most credible. But nonetheless, just excluding everyone because a certain number of them turn out not to be valid is just a logical fallacy, and the skeptics fall prey to that frequently.
Self-avowed Luciferian, his name is Aaron Donahue, mm-hmm. Claims that he was trained by Ed Dames and they had a falling out. Have you ever dealt with him, know of him?
I know of him. I've never had any connection with him. I'm dubious of a lot of his claims. I'm not saying he's not a remote viewer, perhaps even a good one. I have no way of evaluating that. But he's an example, I think. I don't want to pick on anybody in particular, but he's an example, someone who makes outrageous claims, some of which might be true, but some of which aren't, tends to hurt the community at large, I think.
Well, what are they out for? Notoriety? Money? What's the motive?
Yes. It can be any of those
or
things.
Or all of the above, more. Right?
I'm sorry?
All of the above.
Yes. Well, it depends. Different people have different needs. And throughout human history, you've had people who make outrageous claims either to get gain or to get attention or to influence people in some way. This is not new in society, and it's not just peculiar to the paranormal, so to speak.
Paul, it's kind of strange because I've been reading up a lot on a subject that fascinates me, and that's end times, mm-hmm. Especially the book of Revelation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look at signs and symbols that are occurring right now, one could assume we may be in end times.
Mm-hmm.
However, the more research I've done, I have found out that there have been every civilization involved on this planet. Everybody has always thought they were in end times.
Yes.
From the beginning, they've made predictions that it's the end of the world, that the Antichrist is coming on this date, mm-hmm. and the date would come, and they'd move it back again.
It happened many times within recorded history. Yeah.
Yes. So I'm wondering again if this situation we're in, if we are truly in end times, or if once again we're in the midst of a false deadline and date.
And that's always the $64,000 question. I happen to belong to a church, the LDS or Mormon Church, which, you know, it's in its name, it says Latter-day Saints, right?
Right.
Has the idea that we are living in end times, although it doesn't give a set date when this is going to happen. It's just we're in the end times. When it happens, we'll know that, right? We just should live our lives so that we're ready for it when it comes. But that notwithstanding, it's clear that people have believed this throughout the ages, and it hasn't been the end times, at least as they have conceived it. Some of the Gnostics and some of the Essenes also in ancient Israel believed that the end times were there. Well, it turned out they were for them, but not in the way they thought.
we might all have our own little end times.
Yes, exactly, and certainly we do. I mean, that's the one thing that we know about human existence, is that each of us will have our own end time at some point.
You just don't know when.
That's right.
I don't want to remote view that.
No, although some people want to, and I think that's a shame. One of the problems with knowing the future is, let's say you succeed in knowing the future, and it's your own future, and you know either that you're going to have a wonderful, glorious future of some sort, you're going to inherit $1 million, win the lottery, whatever that is, or you're going to have a really ugly, grisly death in 3 years, whatever, right? The problem, there's a very great liability to that. If you have a really nice event going to happen in the future, you always live your life looking forward to that event, and you miss the here and now. If you're going to have a very bad end in a certain period of time, then you live your life in dread of that, and you miss the here and now. And to me, frankly, knowing the future isn't nearly what it's cracked up to be.
Do you think you can alter the future, though? Let's make an assumption that somehow you've got this ability to see your death,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to die in a horrible car crash, mm-hmm. on February 8th of 2012, and you're going to be at this intersection. And so you're panicking until then. You've got 6 years to worry about it. But, you know, eventually you're going to meet the Grim Reaper and get to that date. Do you have the ability to alter events by, let's say, not going outside, not driving that day? Or would you stay home and then a ladder falls and hits you on the head and you die of a concussion? I mean, can you get away from what you might see for the future?
You know, actually, I treat this question a bit in my book. After I describe the start session that I related a few minutes ago, I talk about the nature of time in the future, and I don't go so much into whether you can alter it, because ultimately what I conclude is that there is no such thing as the future, at least as of right now. So, in other words, I don't believe the future exists, and I frankly think that the overall remote viewing data bears that out. My model, and this is not unique to me, there are a lot of other folks that have this same notion, is that we have a braided future of all kinds of possible futures, none of which have been realized yet. And what affects which one of those alternate futures ends up being realized is the sequence of what I call decision nodes that are tripped as we get from here to there. So whether I walk out the front door or the back door of my house may affect my future and whether I get hit by a meteorite walking out the back, but I wouldn't if I walked out the front, right? Obviously, my future is dramatically curtailed if I get hit by the meteorite. But all of these kinds of decision modes lay out there in front of us. Now, there's an added complicator here in that the world is really, at least in the Newtonian sense, deterministic, at the Newtonian level, deterministic, so that there's a lockstep cause and effect that stretches from the Big Bang all the way up to the future. But something I've come to conclude is that that human consciousness plays a spoiler role in determinism. So that because humans can make what I believe to be undetermined choices, perhaps not many, but at least a limited set of undetermined choices, we can alter how the future goes to many respects. Now, there are some futures that are going to happen no matter what. The earthquake that created that tragic tsunami a while back, that probably lay across a bunch of these time streams because it was hugely deterministic and it was going to happen, and human consciousness could do very little to stop that. But there are many other events in the future, many other time streams, that human consciousness can change depending on the choices that we make individually and corporately. And so, consequently, that implies that we can change the future at least to a limited extent. But the problem is we can also only see the future to a limited extent.
That is absolutely true. Paul, when we come back after the break, can you give us some tips on how to practice remote viewing? You might not be able to train us, but can you get us into the practice stage?
Sure.
All right. We'll be back in a moment, Paul Smith. The next hour, we'll open up the phone lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Paul Smith, our guest, author of Reading the Enemy's Mind. Website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Paul, what have you been doing lately since we last talked and after I met you in Austin, Texas last year?
Well, I had to get admitted to candidacy in my PhD program, so I spent all last semester on academics and didn't do much of the remote viewing. But now I'm making up for that with a vengeance. I've got a lot of things going on. First, of course, is the remote viewing conference. I've been the chair of the last several remote viewing conferences, an organizer, and this year as well, the International Remote Viewing Association, which I'm also a director and an officer in, we try and sponsor a remote viewing conference every year as opportunity allows, and we're having one this year in May in Las Vegas, and actually we're having some pretty interesting folks come to the conference, which maybe we can talk about shortly.
Sure.
But I also have been working on doing some speaking engagements. I'm going to talk actually to a counterterrorism conference. I'm going to introduce remote viewing to a bunch of counterterrorist experts out in New York City, also in May. And I have some regional seminars going on. You'd mentioned opportunities for people to learn a little bit about remote viewing, maybe how to do it, to get the mode where they get at least introduced to it. I have what I call seminar workshop program where, because it involves both lecture and hands-on, and I've got a couple of those scheduled, one in Mobile, Alabama, week after next, and another one out in Sedona, Arizona. So there's a lot cooking as far as my involvement in remote viewing. Of course, the most exciting thing was that my book was the book feature in the March 2006 Reader's Digest. And that, I think, got a lot of attention for not just my book and myself, but actually for remote viewing in general.
I think you're right. Absolutely. Well, now let's talk a little bit about the why nots with remote viewing, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? How come we haven't found Osama bin Laden with remote viewing? How come we haven't found Natalie Holloway, the girl in Aruba who's disappeared? Why doesn't it work for that?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that. One is that it can work for that, but there are some other issues involved that aren't necessarily connected to remote viewing. One is that trying to get people to listen to you if you're a remote viewer is very difficult. If they don't come and ask you for the information, they usually do not welcome volunteered information from someone like a remote viewer. The other thing is there are so many people who want to volunteer that kind of information, and they call themselves remote viewers or psychics or whatever, and there's no quality control. Some of them may well be good remote viewers or good psychics, but a bunch of them are not. So, for example, a friend of mine, in fact, it was Bill Ray, who used to command the remote viewing program when I was in it. He now still works as a counterintelligence agent for the U.S. government. I probably shouldn't have said his name. he told me of an encounter he had with a resident agent from the FBI in one of his, you know, visits to office visits. So she said, I just can't believe this stuff. You know, what she was griping is people claiming to be remote viewers had sent in this data, and on the surface of it, it looked credible. And because, of course, they're obligated to follow every lead, they had to track down all of these things, and they found out that none of them that they checked out paid off, panned out. And so she was getting very frustrated because it was like she was being stuffed with all of this information, none of which was real information, and it took time away from perhaps more legitimate leads. The problem is that not everybody who thinks they're a remote viewer is a remote viewer. It takes a lot of practice, and it takes learning the right principles to be a remote viewer. The further issue is, of course, now this is a remote viewing issue, it doesn't always work. Sometimes you swear you're getting signaling data and it turns out not to be valid for whatever reason. Okay, so that's some background in answer to your question. The next thing is, sometimes when you remote view a high profile case, you get a lot of noise out there. Because, for example, I'm sorry, what was the little girl that was JonBenet Ramsey in Colorado? Everybody and their dog wanted to remote view JonBenet Ramsey. But, of course, every talk show host in the country was talking about JonBenet Ramsey. All the newspapers were full of papers about it. All the newspapers were full of stories about it. All the evening news had, you know. There was this huge psychic, in all terms of that word, psychic cacophony of noise out there. And doing an accurate remote viewing in that setting would be very difficult. High-profile targets, I think, presents some difficulty just because of the noise level that's being generated.
Well, that's true. You may be right, but you can see how it falls into the skeptic's hands mm-hmm. when high-profile cases aren't solved by remote viewers.
Well, this is interesting. I'm glad you bring this up because I've listened to the interviews you had Michael Shermer on
right.
in the past few months, and a couple of times he said that. He said, you know, all this lab stuff, laboratory experiment, that doesn't convince me. But if you could find Osama bin Laden, that would convince me. That's, in a way, a double standard for, and I'm not laying this just on Shermer, but a lot of skeptics make that kind of a statement. The amazing Randy does the same thing with his $1.2 million prize, you know. Show me this one instance of where you're successful in Psi, and then I'll believe you. Well, the fact of the matter is, skeptics tend, at least the ones who understand science, skeptics tend to say, oh, we don't want the anecdotal evidence. That's the onesies and the twosies where you have success. You need to have a robust statistical base to show that there really is something to that, and it isn't just a coincidence. So when Michael Shermer demands, find Osama bin Laden before I'll believe you, he's actually going back on what's supposed to be sound skeptical principles. He's looking for an anecdotal case to prove it, and frankly, even if a remote viewer found Osama bin Laden, I think Michael Shermer and his friends would find some way to explain that away.
Well, yeah, but they might, but at least we'd find the guy.
So that's true. You know? Now, here's the other side of the coin. You know, I think remote viewing can, and it maybe already has found Osama bin Laden. But here's what happens. Remote viewer accesses Osama bin Laden. And let's say he's in a cave. I doubt he's in a cave anymore. If he was in a cave, he probably wasn't in a cave very long. But we'll say he is, okay? The remote viewer is tasked to find Osama bin Laden. Now, of course, the viewer is blind to the target, we presume, hopefully double blind. And if all goes well, the viewer starts reporting on some bearded guy in this long, rock-walled room with a carpet on the floor and guys with guns standing around. Well, then, of course, the analyst is going to say, oh, that's really good. And then the viewer is going to go on and say, okay, and I get the idea he's in this mountainous area where it's barren and austere and dry and arid and reminds me of some third world setting. The analyst is going to say, that's really good. Now, where is he? The viewer is going to say, what do you mean, where is he? I just told you where he is. He's in this rock-walled room with carpet on the floor, you know. And remote viewing is very good at finding things, but it's not very good at locating things because it's a right-brain descriptive methodology, and giving a street address or a geographic coordinate is a left-brain analytic construct, which it's not suited for, and no one that understands the phenomenon has ever claimed that it could do that kind of a thing.
How would you compare remote viewing to psychic thoughts? Because there will be a follow-up question after your response.
Okay. I'm not quite sure what you mean by psychic thoughts.
Well, a psychic. How about that?
Oh, okay. sometimes there's not a lot of difference at all. The very best psychics function probably very similarly to remote viewing, but they tend to do it, they figured out how to do it on their own without any kind of training or protocol, right? So the very best psychics probably are pretty much like the very best remote viewers. I think that what makes all of this parapsychological stuff work is really the same underlying faculty. There's just different ways of getting at it, and some are more successful than others. Now, some psychics aren't nearly as successful as remote viewers because I don't think they understand the process very well, and they've kind of learned hit or miss, and probably there are some things they do that aren't very helpful, but they think they are. But you could say the same for some remote viewers aren't very successful because they don't get it quite right. You know, they have their own ideas about how it might work or whatever. In general, the clean signal is going to be a clean signal no matter how it's generated, as long as the proper protocols are followed and all that.
You remember the West Virginia coal miner story where America was just gripped to that story and, you know, hoping against hope that they would be found alive. And then they came out with that unfortunate false report that they were alive.
That was so bad.
Wasn't that horrible? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I was interviewing Sylvia Brown that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on the air. And I got to tell you, Paul, I got kind of emotional that they had found them alive. And, you know, they thought that one had died. And, you know, and I did my open, and then I went into my interview with Sylvia. And throughout the course of the evening, I asked her, I said, you know, Sylvia, let me ask you this. It's after the fact. I understand that. But had I asked you, you know, so what's going on with the coal miners? What kind of an answer would you have given me? And she said, well, I would have said they would have been found.
Mm-hmm.
And all of our impressions were she meant found alive. Because she was upbeat and bubbly and everything else. Well, I go to a commercial break, Paul, and at that moment, all the media down there realizes that they were wrong. They were listening and took the information the wrong way, that they were all dead but one.
Yeah.
And it was a horrible story. Anyways, we came back from the break, and I said, Sylvia, they're all dead. And she said, well, I knew they'd be found. That's what she said on the second time. After the first time she said that they'd be found alive, the second time she said, well, I knew they'd be found, and they'd be found dead. And I went, she just contradicted herself.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, destroys credibility.
It does. You know, I don't want to pass a judgment on Sylvie Brown because I don't know her record and I have not never met her. But there are psychics out there, and many of them, who have learned to equivocate very efficiently. We hope remote viewers don't do that, and yet I have seen that happen amongst remote viewers as well. A remote viewer is supposed to own up to their failures. Right? If they're properly trained and learn properly, they stand on what they say, and if it turns out to be wrong, they acknowledge that it's wrong, and they go on and try and improve their performance in the future.
Absolutely. You know, to me, if a person can stand up amongst his peers and friends and simply say, you know what? I'm wrong. I can't be right all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And admit that, I think their credibility would zoom.
Not just their credibility, but you know what? In a very interesting way, their accuracy will improve as well. Because if you can acknowledge your failures, if failure doesn't bother you, you actually will be able to remote view better. A good remote viewer has to be totally divorced of whether they succeed or fail and just go for the data. And not, they still won't be successful all the time, but their success will improve because they are no longer ego invested in whether they win or lose, in a sense. They're able to, it's kind of a Zen-like kind of thing, they're able to let go of that, and in a way that helps unclutter the channel, the naturally noisy channel that information comes through.
Well, you know, like this program, Paul, it looks and seeks for the truth. Now, there's no question. It's also shrouded in entertainment. It's shrouded in the bizarre. It's shrouded in fun. It's shrouded in the paranormal. It encompasses all those different aspects of the show. And at any given time, any of them might be going on at any given time. But generally, we want the truth. You know, I want to get to the bottom of remote viewing. I want to get to the bottom of a number of the other issues. You know, we were the first to break the story of the DP World's, the United Airport story, and that thing appears to have died away for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trying to push this other one where the Chinese are controlling a port in the Bahamas, and they're going to inspect for nuclear weapons for us. That's crazy. But we try to find the truth, but we have fun on some other issues.
Uh-huh.
Be that as it may, we come across guests every once in a while who will say, there's a planet X out there in the solar system. It's going to come very close to our planet. It could cause a catastrophe. And we'll interview these people seeking the truth. We'll get other astronomers on who will say, no, that's not true. It's nonsense. And then guess what, Paul? The date comes and goes and nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the person pushes it back by 60 days. The date comes and goes and nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we need to walk a fine line here. But I got to tell you, what you just said was one of the most important things I've heard, and that is you've got to step up to the plate. You've got to admit when you're wrong sometimes and move on from there. And I would have preferred if guests like that who said, Planet X is coming, we're all in trouble, and it didn't come, to simply say, I'm wrong. I think it's still out there, but my dates are screwed up. I don't know why, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But to keep, you know, pushing it back by a month and a week, and we get to those false deadlines, you lose all credibility.
That's true. And in fact, the inability to admit a mistake like that can actually contribute to wilder and wilder tales down the road. Because it's kind of like the same phenomenon where you tell a lie and then you've got to tell another lie. And I'm not saying these folks are lying. I think many of them believe exactly what they're saying. But you tell a lie, and then you have to tell a lie to cover that lie, and you have to tell another lie to cover the lie that's covering the lie, and so on. And it gets out of hand eventually. And I think some of that goes on if you are unable, for whatever reason, to admit a mistake. That happens, I think, to some people who have legitimate psychic ability, where they try and, for example, there's cases where they've, gone on the nightclub circuit or whatever, and you have to succeed when you have an audience like that. Because you can't admit a mistake in that setting, and because whatever this phenomenon is doesn't always work the way you expect it to, some of those folks have to develop these routines where they're actually doing stage magic or stage trickery or whatever. And so when they get up to do their routine, sometimes they get exposed, even though they may have a legitimate ability, because they've had to rely on some false abilities as well to fool people when it doesn't work. They get themselves in trouble, and they throw their whole thing into credibility. And that can happen with these kinds of claims as well.
You know, I had a caller who called about a year ago, claimed to have captured a little dinosaur and had him in a cage. Sends us a picture we post on the website, and it looks like one of those clay, those plastic models of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. You know, it's kind of shrouded. You know, Art interviews a guy who claims he shot an alien and has him in an icebox somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these things go on and on. Some of it entertainment value. Some of it makes you wonder. Others, you sit back and go, you know what? This is absolutely nonsense. It's preposterous. You know, I interview Riley Martin, who claims to get picked up and he goes to Saturn every once in a while. I don't know, but now the guy's doing a national radio show every once in a while. I mean, this is strange stuff.
Well, there's an audience for it. People want to hear this. In fact, that brings to mind a New Testament passage. There's something about people having itching ears wanting to listen to fables rather than the truth. Unfortunately, people are like that. People are actually wired for novelty. Our brains and our psychologies are such that we are attracted by novelty and we like to know new things. It's a survival mechanism. It helps improve fitness in, you know, ecological fit, right? But when we get into our modern world where we have, in a way, short-circuited evolution and natural selection, some of these survival mechanisms tend to get exploited instead for commercial value or whatever. And, I mean, it has to do, you know, for example, pornography and sex, right? Sex is a survival feature of the human race. But you can exploit the mechanisms to make that work, and that's why the pornography industry does so well. And much more benign things, you see that happening as well. And the search for novelty, the network news is now there because it's competing with all the other attempts to provide novelty to people and, you know, who's got the money and, you know, it goes on and on and on.
All right, well, stay with us because now it's your turn. By just simply switching right over to the phone lines, we're going to take your calls. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Paul, has anybody tried to use remote viewing to find the lost Ark of the Covenant or anything like that?
Yes, as a matter of fact. When we were at Fort Meade, there were a number of sessions worked by various viewers there, which tried to describe the location, the current location of the Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, really?
It was interesting.
To say the least. You know, there are some people out there now who think that they're very close to finding it. I wonder if those individuals have used remote viewers to assist them.
Hard to say. You know, of course, remote viewing has been used in archaeological exploration before. And I'm a little promotion here. In fact, at the remote viewing conference, one of those remote viewers is going to be one of our main speakers. I don't think he has worked. His name is George McMullen. I don't think he has worked on the Ark of the Covenant, but I think that it would be a good tool, a useful tool, because there's been success. George is quite successful in that. And you know, it would be intriguing. I know the data that the remote viewers at Fort Meade produced, and I have to, first of all, caveat, it was not an official operation. This was one that was done just on our own. Again, Ed Dames was the ringleader. You know, we, in fact, if our bosses had known we were doing it, they probably would have been mad at us. But nonetheless, the data was fairly consistent across the remote viewing sessions, and some of them, I'm not sure, they may have been front-loaded, but several of them I know were absolutely blind. The viewers had no idea what the target was, including myself, and yet our data seemed to cross-correlate quite persuasively. That data seemed to reveal, and I won't say more about it than this, seemed to reveal that the Ark was still in some place in the Middle East, probably underground in some underground chamber. Now, people are going to say, well, that's just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. It may be. You know, I don't know, but I do know that the viewers were blind and that the data correlated like that. So why it did, I don't know. The suggestion is that maybe the Ark is underground in under some city in the Middle East. My own impression that it was Jerusalem, that it's still in Jerusalem. So you know, of course, that's analysis after the fact, but that was the impression I got.
Did you guys call Ed Dames Dr. Doom in those days?
You know, I don't think so, but it's possible. I kind of don't remember. He's been called that so much in present time,
right,
that it's overlaid what I remember from the past as far as how we referred to him. He certainly was Dr. Doom back then. I mean, he presented us numerous end-of-the-world scenarios while he was with us at Fort Meade. And at first, we actually believed them. After a while, we started taking them with a grain of salt. But nonetheless, you know, it kept us on the edge of our seats sometimes. It was kind of fun.
All right, let's go to the first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Is that me?
Yes, sir. It is.
Hi.
All you. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm John in Scituate, Massachusetts.
Okay. Howdy. Glad to hear from you.
That's the first time I listened to you for ages. You guys have helped me go through a lot of snow plowing.
Oh, well, that's good.
You need to move from Massachusetts.
I emailed you, George, a few times about using remote viewing on with POW/MIA.
Yes, I remember
Vietnam.
That.
Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't trust the government to do anything with remote viewing. And but I'm wondering, could that ever be now after all these years to do anything like that with remote viewing?
In fact, we did do that at Fort Meade. You said you don't trust the government to do it. We actually did a pretty credible job of it. There was an attempted effort earlier in the program, but then when we came online as fully trained controlled remote viewers, coordinate remote viewers back then, one of our very first projects was to remote view possible location of POW/MIAs. And I actually go into this in pretty good detail in my book, so if anybody's interested, they might want to seek that out. But it was very carefully done, very sincerely wanting to find out ground truth. And at least in the locations we were targeted, and I'm not saying that elsewhere might not be the case, but in the locations we were targeted, we produced pretty persuasive evidence that there were no American POW/MIAs at those locations. We developed indicators that they had been there in the past, and it was hard to tell how far back. But at the time we were remote viewed, there were none in those locations at that time.
Well, what about doing them now?
Well, it could be done. Again, it's kind of challenging because, well, you could task the remote viewer, okay, describe POW/MIAs, American POW/MIAs in Southeast Asia present time. And if the viewer produced information, that would be an indicator, but it wouldn't be proof. And the reason for that is a odd phenomenon known as telepathic overlay, where, and I'll use the UFO example here because it's more clear-cut and obvious. Let's say that someone wants you to remote view a UFO event. Now, some UFO events probably really did happen. There's others that are just imagination, that they didn't happen. And let's say this is one of those cases where he wants you to remote view a UFO event. It never happened, but the tasker, the person that's giving you the assignment, really believes it did happen and has this mental idea of how that thing unfolded. Well, the viewer subconscious goes out into RV space, whatever that is, you know, out in the ether, and the subconscious finds, well, there's nothing here. Nothing happened. But the conscious awareness isn't aware of that, keeps looking. And so the subconscious then looks for the next most powerful psychic signal. Well, it just happens to be the beliefs of the tasking person. And so the viewer comes back with this report. Yeah, there's UFO, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? And so the tasker then is reinforced in his or her belief that it really did happen, even though it didn't.
All right.
Are you following me?
Yeah, I gotcha.
Okay. So it's possible that if you're tasked by a person who really believes there's still POW/MIAs out there, and I'm not committed one way or the other on this. Obviously, there are still people missing in action. There's no question about that. If the person really believes that they're out there in a certain place, then the viewer goes out there and, let's say, finds nothing, nonetheless may come back and report because of this telepathic overlay that there are POWs and MIAs out there, and you can't really tell unless you can get actual on-the-ground verification of some way. And then, of course, you've answered the question on your own.
So it's because it's swayed by their own personal belief.
It can be, yes. It's always dangerous to have someone tasking, viewing, or assisting in some way who has a very strong personal involvement or investment in a project.
Okay, so you wouldn't get a veteran who has strong beliefs to do it.
You probably wouldn't want to do that. You'd want to get somebody who's neutral because then you can rely on the data a little bit better.
Ah, I gotcha. Well, great. Thank you, Paul.
You bet. Right. Thanks for the question.
Thank you, George. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, John. Appreciate you being part of the program. That is a good way to do it, Paul, because if you bring people in who have, I guess we can say a bias, for lack of a better phrase and word, it could skew the remote viewing.
Absolutely. It makes it harder to tell whether you've got real data or not. I want to jump in for a second because I realize we forgot to follow through on a promise we made earlier, and that was to tell people how they could actually having a remote viewing experience themselves.
Oh, we didn't forget. I was ready to pounce on that.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to pounce now? I'll give you just a very brief answer, actually.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, this is kind of a shortcut. Actually, I have put on both my website and on the International Remote Viewing Association website a general discussion about how you can set up your own remote viewing experiment. And if you go to either of those websites, my website, rviewer.com, I guess for people who may not have access to the web, rviewer.com, and the International Remote Viewing Association is IRVA, IRVA.org. Both of those have the same article there on how you can actually set up your own remote viewing experience and try it out for yourself.
All right, very good. Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hello?
Yes, sir. Hi. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. My name is Doug from Ridgefield, Washington.
Oh, howdy. I was up there not long ago.
Oh, great, great.
My brother lives in Kennewick.
Okay, yeah. Hey, George, I just want to say I really appreciate the show. Great stuff that you've been sharing with the world here. It's so important. And, Paul, especially what you're talking about is really fascinating. And I just have a couple of comments. First, a question. Are you familiar with the work of David Hawkins?
Yes.
Yes. He's come up with a you know, you're talking about distinguishing the truth of something versus the falsehood of it.
Yes.
He's come up with a very foolproof way using kinesiology.
Oh, really?
To verify the truth of something. He discovered that a body will test weak in the presence of a lie and, you know, strong in the presence of truth. And, you know, so he has been, he's actually in Sedona. You mentioned being in Sedona.
Uh-huh.
Coming up here. He's got a spiritual research institute down there. Very fascinating fellow. Co-wrote a book with Linus Pauling on neuropsychiatry and such. But my point is that you're right on, and what some of the things you're saying really are in line with his work. And you know, this whole remote viewing thing is very true and very accurate, and the skeptics don't get it yet because they're working from a limited paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And my other point was, and I'll listen to your comments off the line, was that so much of what we're discovering in parapsychology and in the spiritual realms are things that are already validated in other spiritual cultures on the planet, particularly the Hindu culture and the Chinese culture, more advanced spiritual cultures, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just would love to hear your comments on that.
Yes, I think they are more advanced in certain respects, of course, but they are not as advanced in other respects. No culture is perfect, obviously, and some cultures have advantages, others don't have, and vice versa. I think they do have an advantage in that they are perhaps more closely attuned to what we might call spiritual aspects of human nature, and that's good. The West could learn some things from that. Whether or not we will, who knows?
Yeah, I do. We don't hear of Chinese remote viewers, though, do we?
Well, you know, of course they have the Qigong, which I think there's some relevant relationships between the two. There is some indication that Chinese are looking into this stuff fairly seriously. Now, of course, you run into the problem that they have a Marxist government right now. And Marxism, by definition, is a materialist, and bound to be a bit dubious about all this. Consequently, any research into the field at all is going to be heavily controlled and probably working from some sort of physicalist or materialist perspective, which I think if you limit yourself to that, you're bound to not make the kind of progress that you would if you would acknowledge that some things in the world may not in fact be physical or material.
Let's go next to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, Paul. Good morning, George. This is Steve calling from KSTE.
Sure,
Sacramento.
Sacramento.
Mm-hmm. How are you?
Good.
We spoke not that long ago, George. I'm the person whose grandmother visited me and the furniture was moved in the house.
Right. I remember that.
Yeah. You have my phone number, the producer. I gave it to him. Anyway, I called because you mentioned on that occasion that I have visions on occasion, and I've never really applied myself, but once in a while, there'll be an item where someone was abducted and they couldn't find the body. And I have in my mind, I get a picture of the person and the posture and whether they're beneath the ground, if they're laying on the side, back, if they're near a tree or near a water, or which direction they're facing in relation to voters on. And sometimes I can actually get a general geographical location within like 4 or 5 miles of where this might be found. I don't know if that is a remote viewing or if there's something there that I can work with, that I can help someone with. I just know. Yeah.
I have to tell you, actually, it's kind of funny. When you said abducted, I was thinking aliens for a minute.
Now, this one was a real one, yeah.
Abducted by in some criminal act or other. What you've described could very possibly be a sort of just spontaneous remote viewing kind of experience. And you've described it the way remote viewing kind of does it, where you get the surroundings, the setting of the target, whatever that target may be, in this case apparently an abducted person, but you really can't say, well, I know where that is. You would recognize the spot perhaps when you got there, or if you recognize something that is sort of a landmark, you could do that. You could guide people to it. But that's the big problem in what we call the search problem remote viewing is providing locational data, not just describing the setting that the target is in. You probably can't help much unless you in some way refine your information so that you can provide guidance for somebody who's actually searching for that person. And it might be that you'll identify some particular landmark or some characteristics of the target that could be useful. Now, on the other hand, it may not be veridical at all. People do have impressions, have experiences that turn out to be some other, quirk of psychology or whatever. It doesn't mean you're crazy or anything. This just happens to people. In fact, one of the big obstacles to overcome in remote viewing is something we call analytical overlay, which is basically your left brain trying to tell your right brain what it's experiencing.
You could actually, you could think yourself out of good remote viewing.
You can. In fact, that's a very high probability thing in remote viewing unless you learn how to deal with that overlay.
Dames was telling me, Paul, that the least you concentrate, just by letting things float into your head and then, jot them down, draw sketches, whatever you do, that is the proper way for him. Mm-hmm. And, when he starts to trying to analyze and think, he said it never works.
Well, never a bit strong, but it's unlikely to work, let's put it that way, because there's always exceptions in remote viewing. But generally, I'd say that's a pretty good way of putting it. There's no real good way of explaining how it feels or how it's like. Everybody has a different way of explaining it, but I think they're all trying to express and describe the same experience. Remote viewing is, again, a bit zen-like in that you don't try and quiet your mind, you don't try and blank your mind, chase every thought out of it. First of all, that's impossible anyway, just because of the way our minds work. But it's more of a Zen process where you will let it come in, you sort it out, and let it go out to where it should go out. So you learn to recognize analytical overlay, and you learn what to do with it. And you let it come in, and you let it go out. And when you succeed in being able to do that consistently, your remote viewing ability improves dramatically.
I was going to say, the more you can practice, the better you should get. Is that the case?
As long as you're practicing correctly. Now, obviously, if you're going to play the piano and you practice the song wrong every time, you're going to reinforce the wrong thing.
Right? You're going to play it wrong. That's right.
That's right. And the same thing happens remote viewing. If you don't get the principles down right, fortunately, there's a fair amount of leeway, but nonetheless, if you don't get the principles right, if you practice it incorrectly, you're not going to progress at the rate you may want to.
All right, well, stick with us. We're going to be back for final phone calls with our special guest, Paul Smith, Reading the Enemy's Mind. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with Paul Smith. Paul, did Ingo Swann ever talk with you about what he thinks he remote viewed on the moon regarding aliens on the moon and bases? It's an incredible story.
He didn't talk directly about that, but as a matter of fact, I guess I can talk about this now. He asked me to do some sessions for him against anomalies on the moon. And he gave me his essentially final collection of the, and it included sessions he'd worked, sessions another person had worked, and plus my sessions as well. And there were some very interesting, again, very interesting correlations between those other sessions and the material I developed. Now, of course, I know some of his other stories. None of that material, for example, within his book Penetration, ended up in being subject to, you know, the things I remote viewed or the things in this particular project. But nonetheless, very intriguing. I think we need to go find out what's going on there.
What do you think is going on there?
Well, I'm very cautious about this stuff. I can tell you what my remote viewing session developed to some degree. It's been a while since I looked at it. But I think I did three or four of them. Whether or not it's veridical, you know, I can't say until we go and check it out. I mean, it could be, again, a case of telepathic overlay. Maybe Ingo believed something about what's going on the moon. But nonetheless, just based on what I had in my sessions, there do seem to be some odd things going on involving apparent intelligent-type activity. a lot of it seems to be underground. And there are some coming and going with some kind of transportation device. That was basically what my information developed and my sessions developed. Again, I'm not saying it's really like that. All I know is what I worked in a essentially blind, remote viewing blind condition. I produced that data, and it did correlate with some of the other material developed by Ingo and this other fellow.
So we have separate sources then coming up with somewhat similar circumstances.
Yes. Now, again, it's potentially separate. There's always the danger of telepathic overlay in an operation like that. But nonetheless, in a way, I'm not ready to dismiss it. There was something kind of compelling about it in a way.
So. That's fascinating. Yeah. That absolutely is. How's Ingo's health these days? Have you talked to him?
I haven't talked to him in the last week or so. I understand he's got a pretty bad case of the flu, which is why I haven't contacted him. I didn't want to disturb him in those circumstances. But
because he was sick before that, wasn't he?
Well, he had a very serious accident. He slipped on the ice, and, you know, of course, he's now in his 70s, and put him in the hospital for about 2 weeks. But he's recovered pretty well from that. And now he's got the flu, and I hope that's all it amounts to, because he's going to be one of our primary speakers at the remote viewing conference. And in fact, if anybody wants to meet Ingo Swann, this could be the time to do it, because, you know, he is getting on. He would hate to hear me say that, but he is getting on, you know, and he may decide not to come to any more of these. So, if you have the chance, one more plug for the remote viewing conference in May.
I think I have to go to a wedding on that weekend, Paul. If not, I'd love to come up there and see you and Ingo.
Well, you know you have a standing invitation.
Thank you. And he'd probably love to hear some stories about my aunt.
He'd love to talk to you about that, too. You know, there must be some way we can get you two together in the same room at the same time for a while. He would love it, I'm sure, and I think that you'd find it fascinating as well.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Let's pick it up by going to our East of the Rockies line. You're on the air with Paul Smith. Hi there.
Hello, this is Jacob.
Hello.
Hey, Jacob. Go ahead.
From Chanute, Kansas.
Oh, cool.
I got a question. Now, they say that 10% or something like that of the population is left-handed, which they do, I don't know how much research has been done, but they do think in their right mind, correct?
Not necessarily. No, because the hands are cross-wired, and just because you're left-handed doesn't necessarily mean you lean towards use of your right brain. In fact, there's a lot of engineers who tend to be linear thinkers, not across the board, but tend to be, that are left-handed. So
you're saying, like for my instance, I write left-handed, eat left-handed, throw left-handed, but actually I'm right-eye dominant. Mm-hmm. Kick right-footed, bat right-footed, golf right-footed, or right-handed, you know what I'm saying? Kind of like, is that what you're talking about?
You know, all of us are a bit mixed up.
Yeah.
You know, very few of us are unified in one direction or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's it. Thank you very much, guys.
Okay, appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, we'll go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning. morning, George. Good morning, Paul. This
Howdy.
Is Sid calling from Norfolk.
Sure.
I was stationed.
I'm sorry, what was your name?
Sid.
Sid. And from where?
Norfolk.
Oh, Norton. Norfolk. I love that town. All right, go ahead.
I've got three peculiar questions. You referenced General Stubblebine earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Twice in my military career I met him. Once was at the electronics depot a couple hours outside of D.C.
Okay.
And only met him for about 5 minutes. 2.5 years later, met him again at a briefing I was giving in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And amongst all the officers present, he stopped me right at the beginning. He says, I know you from somewhere.
Mm.
Before the end of this briefing, I'll tell you exactly where.
Scary, isn't
now,
it?
During my briefing, he stood there semi-half dazed but still paying attention. And at the end of the briefing, he told me where and when he met me down to the day.
That's impressive.
Is
of course,
did he
remember trained? What you said in the briefing?
Yes.
Oh, good. That's impressive. Now, he's a sharp guy.
He being the top of the food chain on the military side of the remote viewers, was he also trained in it?
Not formally. I think he did play around with it a bit. He tended to get more involved in the PK stuff, the metal bending, and he used that as an object lesson whenever he went around the places. In fact, in my book, I detail, that was my first encounter with any of this stuff was Stubblebine giving a talk to the combined, career schools there at Fort Huachuca. And he starts tossing out bent silverware, you know, psychically bent silverware out in the audience and saying that he and his staff did that. And we're talking about generals and senior colonels and lieutenant colonels. That was pretty astonishing for most of us, you know. So that was interesting. He's an amazing guy. Were you an MI officer?
No, I was enlisted.
Okay.
Fort Devens, the other half of the Intel Center in schools.
Of course, I started out enlisted. So what was your MOS?
33 Sierra.
Oh, okay. All right. Good.
This brings up the other question.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the stressful nature of the course, a major came in there, and we all had a stress relaxation techniques class.
Mm-hmm.
Laying out on the grass, arms out to our sides, palms up, feet together.
Hoping
do not
no one
fall
could
asleep.
See you, right?
Do not fall asleep, no matter what you do. Do not fall asleep and just listen to me.
Okay.
And they talked us literally out of our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately after that, we went into a clearance investigate or background check again.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked us, have you ever sleepwalked? They kept reiterating that question throughout the interview.
Huh.
Now, would the better question be, have you ever dreamed that you've been walking around and look back and see your body laying somewhere? Instead of, have you ever sleepwalked since you're under a clearance background check?
Well, my guess is those were two separate events. The first one was, probably, what year was this?
This was 79 or very early 80.
Okay. The relaxation exercise was probably done under the auspices of the, what was it called, the INSCOM Search for Excellence, which was a program to try and take some of these human development technologies out and introduce them to the intelligence corps.
Okay.
The other thing, my guess, was the standard psychological evaluation that they often did, and you know, for the compartmented clearances that you'd have had to require, that you would have had to have. I don't think they were connected. I'm sorry?
Here's the weird part. My mother passed away in 78, but 2 weeks before she passed away, she started collecting Paul Revere silverware, or silver sets and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
One of the questions on the forms we were filling out said, are you a member of any national organizations, for example, the ACLU, which at that time I'd never heard of, or the Paul Revere Society?
Uh-huh.
The Paul Revere Society, as I find out later from another talk show host, doesn't even exist until 1993. Could it have been remote viewed and perceived as a possible threat in the future?
I doubt that. I think you have to do some research on that. I seem to recall hearing about that society long before 1993.
It was on the forum in 79 and 80.
Yeah. I don't think that's unusual. I think it was an organization similar to the John Birch Society, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong. You know, that's a long time ago. But I doubt that it would have been remote viewed and put on a questionnaire. That would be very unusual. That wasn't the kind of thing that we would have worked, and we were the only ones doing it in the Army at that. Well, I wasn't even in the program yet, but, you know, Joe McMonigle and some of the early remote viewers were the only ones doing it in the Army at the time. So I doubt that that would work. But, you know, I don't know. If I were you, I'd research the Paul Revere Society a little bit more and find out if maybe it did exist before 1993. That just seems way too late to me from what I recall.
All right, thanks for that call, Sid. Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Richard in Spring Hill, Florida.
Hey, Richard, thanks for holding.
I appreciate you taking my call. I've listened to you for quite a while. I've got a question. I'm not sure. I got into this conversation late, and I'm curious, how long have you been doing this with the military?
Oh, forever. No, I started in 1983.
Okay, this was just a little earlier. Did you ever do a remote viewing on Bentwaters Woodbridge?
I have to tell you, I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because we worked a bunch of those kind of targets. Again, it was sub rosa. It was not an official tasking by any means. It was, you know, just kind of an attempt to find out what we could do with this stuff. And we worked a number of these, what I call anomaly targets, among them UFO-type events. And I identified some that I worked and that some of the others worked. And I don't recall if Bentwaters was one of them. And even if it wasn't any of the ones I found, it's still possible we worked it. I just haven't got the data on it.
It might have been better known as Rendlesham.
Oh, yes. Actually, we did work that.
Okay.
I don't know if I did, but I know I found two or three sessions of other folks. In the archives, in the Stargate archives, I found two or three sessions at least that other folks have worked on the Rendlesham Forest. Right now, I can't tell you off the top of my head what the results were. You know, it's been a while since I looked at it, and I've looked at so many sessions over the time. So,
interesting. I've never ever talked about it with, you know, publicly about it. I've talked with friends about it, but I was 81st Security Police Squadron. I was there.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
Send me an email. Get up on my website and send me an email.
You got it. It would be a pleasure to do that.
Okay.
Thanks for being on the program. Next up, west of the Rockies, it's your turn. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Take it away.
Hi. I have a question. I am a civilian employee of the Air Force and work at Edwards Air Force Base. I grew up just east of there, and my family lives in a small valley where a few times a year they have triangles fly over every night.
Mm-hmm.
That will go on for a month to a month and a half. And they will fly over three or four times in the night, and there's about three different ones. So I was wondering, have you ever remote viewed or can shed any information about what these triangles are?
I haven't, actually. One of the things you have to be aware of about remote viewing is you can't pick the targets for yourself. So, for example, let's say I was curious to find out about this. I could not target myself on that because, again, you'd be front-loaded if you did that.
All right.
And all of what you can suspect or think and infer about it is right there and messes up your session. In order to get that information, I would have to task somebody else on that who didn't know what I was giving them to do. And I have never done that. Actually, it didn't occur to me to do it. But then I'm not much into UFOs. I've written a couple articles for UFO Magazine, but they have to do with, you know, the pretty much past history of RV and UFOs and things like that. And I do have in mind to do some more, and so maybe eventually I'll become an expert on UFOs, but I'm not there yet. So.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
You bet. Thanks for your question.
Okay. Appreciate it. Did you know, by the way, Paul, that Bill Burns and I highlight you somewhat in our new book, Worker in the Light, which won't be out until September?
Well, Bill had said he might say some things about me. I had no, I have no idea still to what extent that is. But
we said some good things about you.
Well, I am very pleased. In my next book, I'll say good things about you, too.
Okay. And then on my next one after that, I'll say good things about you.
Hey, I think we've got a real good deal going here.
You've got it. Let's take another call. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thanks.
My name is Chris. I'm calling from Washington.
Okay.
Okay, Chris.
And I had a question. You kind of answered this a little bit before, but I was wondering, like, could you remote view, like, to other planets?
Actually, that's been done. Of course, there's the lunar things I talked about. And then Ingo Swann is famous for having remote viewed Jupiter before one of our space probes got there and identified that Jupiter, like Saturn, has rings. We just couldn't see them from here. interestingly as well, some of our training targets were Mars. Now, some of them are a little more controversial than others. Joel McMonagle, for example, is famous for having remote viewed Mars and described underground facilities and an ancient race of Martians which was no longer there and a whole bunch of stuff. He talks about that in his book, Mind Trek. He has since questioned whether he was really remote viewing Mars or instead picking up on stuff he read later on in his life, and that kind of polluted the signal. Who knows what that is? But a little more straightforward, one of our targets was, what is it? Was it Viking that landed on Mars? I forget. One of our earliest Mars landers was one of our targets. A number of the remote viewers at Fort Meade, just as a training, were given the coordinates for that and actually described it fairly accurately. And so there you go. You can remote view another planet.
Okay, I got one other question.
Okay.
Sure, go ahead.
I was wondering if it's possible to remote view and not know it, and then maybe, say, go to a place you remote viewed and have deja vu?
I'd say it's possible. I'm not quite sure how you'd tell that's what happened, but, you know, it's within the realm of possibility, and that's probably the best answer I can give you.
You know how we were earlier talking about how it takes time to see and then have the brain register, so it's almost like we're time traveling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Paul, what are the possibilities that deja vu truly is just that? Events that we see that we really haven't registered yet, and then somehow the mind flips it.
Well, of course, that's one of the explanations for deja vu. You know, a scientifically based one, I guess you could say. The idea is that it's just kind of a delay loop in the brain, temporary delay loop that makes you think you've experienced it a second time, when in reality you're just perceiving it in a delayed way. I think that deja vu is probably explainable that way, but I think there probably are deja vu experiences where you do have some precognitive awareness of that event. The peculiar thing about it is oftentimes there's no real meaningful content there. Oftentimes when you have spontaneous psi, when people experience a spontaneous psychic event, there's some real meaning. You know, their child is in danger, a relative has died, those kinds of things. Those are things that are reported. Louisa Ryan made a large study of those kinds of things. But these deja vu things oftentimes are just meaningless. They're just, you know, there they are. Doesn't have any.
They're just out there. Paul, thanks for being on the program.
Oh, you are quite welcome.
The enemy's mind, Paul Smith. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Rob Ismail, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, and Ian Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.